Sometimes you have to kill nature to understand it. Charles Darwin killed reams of animals for his collection on board the HMS Beagle. Those specimens later helped him crack the mystery of evolution. In our time, Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson once fumigated an entire island so he could see how the birds and insects repopulated it. And on a much humbler scale, essayist Anne Fadiman has fond memories of a childhood spent collecting butterflies. In a new essay called Collecting Nature, she writes that although she and her brother taught themselves a lot about insect identification, they also felt a certain thrill in the kill. Fadiman read a passage from her essay for Steve Paulson.
When did we realize that this was horrible? My brother and I had started collecting butterflies when he was 8 and I was 6. Shame set in about 2 years later. I remember a period of painful overlap when the light of decency was dawning, but the lure of sin was still irresistible. Like alcohol, nicotine, or heroin, lepidoptery is hard to renounce. A tiger swallowtail is an unbelievable thing to find in your backyard, a big butterfly, 5 inches across, striated with yellow and black, with blue splotches on the hind wings, rendered iridescent by light diffracting scales. Who would not wish to take such a creature home? To swoop your net through the air and see something fluttering inside? To snatch that bit of life from the rich chaos of nature into your own comparatively lackluster world, which had instantly brightened and enlarged? To look it up and name it and know it? Well, after you did that a few times, it was hard to muster much enthusiasm for Parcheesi.
What you get at in this essay is both the joy of insect collecting, but also the sad fact that it involves a lot of killing. You almost can't have one without the other, can you?
Well, there are some kinds of nature collecting that don't involve killing. You can collect shells along the beach that have already lost their animals. You can collect an abandoned bird's nest. But if you're going to collect butterflies, you pretty much have to kill them. And that's the difference between collecting butterflies and collecting stamps. You don't have to murder the stamps.
And this is an old story in natural history. I mean, some of the great biologists throughout history were also great collectors, and they didn't seem to have any qualms about killing for their collections.
They had no qualms because collecting enabled them to form their theories. That is, the three great biological theorists of the 19th century, Alfred Russel Wallace, Henry Walter Bates, and Charles Darwin, were all collectors. And when I say collectors, I mean collectors on a really, really big scale. When Wallace went to the Malay Archipelago in the 1860s, he brought home more than 125,000 specimens. Imagine. And when Bates went to the Amazon, he came back with 14,000 new species that he had discovered. And Darwin, of course, was able to develop his theory of natural selection only by examining all the specimens that he brought home, the ones that he'd so carefully cleaned and stuffed and pickled while he was fighting seasickness in the poop cabin of the HMS Beagle.
For someone like Wallace, at least, he seemed to be pretty upfront about the thrill that came with not only catching the thing that he was collecting, but also killing it. At one point, he referred to the excitement to feel it struggle between one's fingers.
Yes, he did. Interestingly, in a later reprinting of that particular passage, that phrase was left out. I think it was regarded as too shocking. But for Wallace, that was the crucial difference between seeing a specimen in a museum and catching it yourself. The murder was part of the excitement.
Now, like many of us, you were a collector yourself as a kid. You write about how you and your older brother would go out collecting insects. Did you take a certain amount of pleasure in the kill?
Up until a certain age, partly because it was so exciting to have that power. I started collecting butterflies with my brother when I was 6. And when you get a butterfly in a net, of course, it's tremendously exciting that you've plucked out of the sky something that is yours. But it becomes even more yours if you kill it. That is, if you put it in the killing jar, which has carbon tetrachloride in the bottom, and then you put it in the relaxing jar, which enables you to push the wings down and flatten it, and then you put it on the spreading board, and then you put it in a Riker mount. A few years later, it dawned on me and my brother that we were doing something truly horrible. But I think that for us, it was a childlike analog to what hunting might mean for an adult man, a way to go out into nature and feel that it's yours.
Hmm. Now, there's another piece to animal collecting. It's not just the catching of the animals. It's also the naming of them and the classifying of them. This is really the basis of natural history, isn't it?
It is the basis of natural history. It's saying these two things look alike. How closely related are they? How can we divide the world into families and genera and species? And in the 19th century, when people were particularly foraying out from England and going to other continents, I think it was a form of imperialism. That is, when they saw an animal that had probably had a local name for centuries and said, I name it X, and then they gave it a double name, Latin, Linnaean nomenclature, it was like saying, we are taking this thing from Africa or Asia or the Malay Archipelago, and we're making it a little British Crown colony.
Now, I get the sense that you and your brother had your own quite extensive collection of all kinds of things, not just insects, but other stuff. And you have a passage about this. I'm wondering if you could read that.
I would be happy to.
And this was what you called the Serendipity Museum of Nature?
Yes, the Serendipity Museum of Nature, no smoking, please, as the blue Dymo label maker sign on the door read. We displayed not only things that had once been alive, but things that had once contained life. The discarded skin of a garter snake, the exoskeleton of a cicada, the speckled egg of a scrub jay, the pendant nest of a Baltimore oriole. Blowfish dangled from the ceiling on strands of dental floss. In the southeast corner, pinned to the wall, were scraps of fur. Leopard, tiger, polar bear, rabbit, otter, nutria, mink, left over from coats tailored by a local furrier. Next to them was a man-sized piece of styrofoam into which we'd stuck hundreds of feathers. On the west wall, we had nailed a desiccated sand shark, which looked like a crucified demon. Shelves and card tables held, among other things, a stuffed mouse, a stuffed bat, the skeleton of a pit viper, a hornet's nest, a mounted ostrich egg, a hunk of petrified wood, the fossils of ammonites and foraminifers, several dried salamanders, a dead tarantula, three dead scorpions, a sperm whale tooth, a box of our own baby teeth, the foot of an egret, a pickled squid, a pickled baby octopus, and a pickled human tapeworm, about which I am said to have exclaimed when I received it on my 10th birthday, just what I always wanted. There were also about a dozen bird and mammal skulls that we had retrieved from road kills and cleaned with bleach. Pending their Clorox baths, our mother permitted us to wrap the corpses in aluminum foil and store them in the freezer, as long as we labeled them clearly enough to prevent her from confusing them with dinner.
I have to say, you had very understanding parents.
We had really understanding parents. They let us fill a spare bathroom with dirt in order to keep a California king snake. They let us nail whale baleen to the wall. They let us do a whole lot of things that I probably wouldn't let my own children do. But thank God that I had my parents as parents and didn't have me.
Anne Fadiman's most recent essay collection is called At Large and At Small. She spoke with Steve Paulson.